All rise. Supreme Court of the State of Colorado is now in session. Chief Justice Rice presiding.
Thank you.
Please be seated.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Are you all hearing me okay? Yes? What about you? It doesn't feel like the microphones are on, but if you're hearing fine, that's good.
You want it closer?
So we're here today to handle our first case, which is called Burnett versus the State of Colorado. I heard there was a storm coming, I guess. All right, so the first case is called Burnett versus the State of Colorado. What I'm going to do is ask the lawyers to introduce themselves to the court, and we'll start with the lawyers for Ms. Burnett. If you would do so, please.
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Tim R. Fowler, registration number 15983, on behalf of the plaintiff and petitioner, Sarah Burnett. With me at counsel table is Alan Mulk, trial counsel. And also joining us today is John Hoare, who has wrote the amicus brief for the court. Frederick Court, please.
Thank you. Mr. Fowler, will you be doing all of the argument today?
Your Honor, I will do the principal argument. We did file a motion, which was granted, allowing the amicus counsel to argue as well.
All right.
And if I may, my plan would be to argue for approximately 15 minutes and give approximately 10 minutes to amicus.
That's fine, Mr. Fowler. You'll have to keep track of your own time, sir, if you'll do so, please.
Of course, Your Honor. Thank you.
And who is the attorney for the State of Colorado? All right, Ms. Spaulding, thank you. This case is set for an hour. That means each side has 30 minutes to present an argument. The petitioner, Ms. Burnett, can reserve some time, if Mr. Fowler wishes, to respond to the arguments made by Ms. Spaulding. Mr. Fowler, did you wish to start, please, sir?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Rice, opposing counsel Ms. Spaulding, Principal Goodrich, visiting dignitaries, Commissioner, City Attorney, and Chief. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to argue this case today. As I indicated, I'll try to reserve 10 minutes for the amicus counsel and 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll keep my own time. Thank you. May I begin?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to start at a practical level that deals with the four components of the waiver, dangerous condition definition, and maintenance. Burnett's position is not that the state must maintain and prune every tree in Cherry Creek State Park. Burnett's position is simply that the trees that are adjacent to, incorporated into specific campsites that overhang the improvements, including the improved tent pad for camping overnight, should be reasonably maintained within the definition of what's a dangerous condition under the Governmental Immunity Act. Ms. Burnett was using that campsite number 14 precisely as it was designed, built, and maintained for the public. She was camping at night in the designated pad, and it was offered to her for that purpose by the state. Burnett's position is consistent with the dissent authored by Judge Caparelli in the Court of Appeals, of course. It's our position that the dissent is both well-reasoned and rather thorough. It supports our position, and we would adopt that argument, and I will not rehash the dissent per se. I'll make comment on it on occasion. This court, to grant the relief we seek on behalf of Ms. Burnett, does not need to provide a sweeping construction of the recreational area waiver. It does not mean to hold that every tree must be maintained. And the CGIA, Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, need only require that the state provide reasonably safe recreational areas. The key fact in this case is that the state already, prior to his accident and injury to Ms. Burnett, maintained the campground, this campsite, and specifically has admitted in the stipulated facts that it had pruned the trees in the campground on previous occasions, and specifically had pruned the tree, one of the trees above and around campsite number 14. So at the final analysis, when you talk about whether the trees are incorporated into the campsite or not, the fundamental point from Burnett and the question for the court would be, why would the state prune trees if they were indeed in their natural condition located on unimproved property? The state's pruning those trees because they're part of the campground, part of the campsite, and they pose a risk to the campers invited to use that particular site.
Council,
Could
you help us, though, understand how you would draw that line?
Of course.
I understand you base it on the conduct of the state, but perhaps you could wind that into the statutory definition of improved or unimproved. Can you help me understand how it fits into the statute?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. Improved versus unimproved. What's critical here is the state stipulated that campsite number 14 is an improved facility, for starters. So that's improved because there was a sewer hookup, electrical hookup, water hookup, fire pit, picnic table, and tent pad. So those are clearly improvements, and they've already admitted and conceded it's a public facility. So we don't have that issue, really, in this case. Then we get to there are two exceptions to the waiver of immunity. The first being natural condition, the natural condition of unimproved property. Okay, that does not apply, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, the trees are no longer in their natural condition. A campsite with all those man-made improvements have been put and nestled in and among those trees and around those trees. As the photograph attached to the brief shows, there are at least four trees surrounding the improved tent pad. Those are in extremely close proximity. They're not 10 feet away, they're inches away. That's visible from the photograph itself. Secondly, the trees have been pruned, admittedly, and the photograph shows one limb that had been pruned. Those are not trees in their natural condition because of the maintenance. Third, the state has, in their answer brief, admitted openly and quite explicitly that the state, by design, incorporated the risk of branches falling by the way they situated and built campsite number 14. Therefore, for those reasons, those trees are no longer in their natural condition. Second, and then the other part of the exception to the waiver are those trees on unimproved land? Three reasons they're not. One, they're so close to the man-made improvements in campsite 14 that they've altered their condition. I covered that initially. Two, they're part of the campground overall, which is a designated park area. And third, of course, they're part of the park.
So does your position rely on the improved campsite? I mean, what if she was standing in the more natural area and the branch fell, but it was still a pruned tree? What would happen then?
Okay, here's Burnett's conclusion. We've got trees in campsite 14 that are really within the campsite. Your question is if they're off outside of the campsite. Let's assume first that there's one tree, say, 20 yards just from the campsite. Okay, and there's no man-made improvements surrounding it. Okay, and Ms. Burnett happened to walk over there to watch the sunset, and a branch fell and hit her. She would be on unimproved property. The tree had not been pruned. Okay, so it would be in its natural state. Therefore, the exception for the natural condition of unimproved property would apply in that instance. There would be no waiver. Okay? So, if you take another example, if someone was way out in the park, in the brief I said frolicking in a meadow or something, clearly there would be no waiver because of the exception. It would be in an unimproved area of the park, and it would be in its natural condition. The closer question is, what if the tree was just the branches overhung, not the campsite, but just the perimeter, say within several feet of the perimeter of the campsite, and Miss Burnett walked over there to view the sunset, and a branch fell and struck her? That would be closer, because she's so close to the campsite. But again, as long as she was not occupying and using campsite number 14 for recreational purposes, and the tree was in the natural condition, there'd be no exception to the waiver. Because the tree, if that tree was in this natural condition, and she was off the facility, off the admitted facility of campsite 14, there'd be no waiver.
Well, why do we care where she is? Don't we just care where the tree is?
Well, we care where she is for a couple reasons.
Okay.
First, the definition of dangerous condition has two parts. Obviously, the first part is there a condition that affects the physical, something that affects the physical condition of the facility. The other is the use of the facility. Okay? So when it comes to the use, what Ms. Burnett's doing is highly relevant. And what's critical in this case, unlike the trilogy announced some months ago, is Ms. Burnett unquestionably is utilizing a highly improved man-made facility in which the state is admitted as an improved facility. So her use is relevant. She was hit not off outside the campsite. She was in her tent at night on the designated pad. So her use is relevant for that reason.
Is it relevant, though, to the natural condition on unimproved property?
Not so much. Not so much. I think it would be a kind of a fact question to some extent in that situation. Another example we could talk about is, what if we had a dirt trail that just went through a meadow and then into the forest, and there were trees, and a hiker happened to go down the trail and be hit by a fallen branch? There would be some improvement because of the dirt trail. And if the tree's in the natural condition, okay, that's use, it's recreation, it's in the park. Now, the fact is, we're in the park on this case, not like the trilogy. So there's not a big question about, are we inside a designated area or not in a designated area. So in the trail example, I'm at 20 minutes. Let me finish this and let me just go.
You have 20 minutes left.
Oh, thank you. I'm ahead of schedule. Thank you. In the trail situation, then the question, implying the plain language of the exception to the waiver for the natural condition of unimproved land. The land is certainly not highly improved, okay? The tree is in its natural condition, and then the question would be, would the trail constitute an improvement or a facility? Odds are, looking under the trilogy of the cases you've recently announced, because they're just not really connected enough and improved enough, whether Gunnar Daniel, Young, or St. Brain. So I think, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Councilor Grant, follow up on your earlier argument. How much of your position really hinges on the fact that the tree branches overhanging this particular site had in fact been pruned? I'm sorry?
A great deal.
So if, for example, those branches had not been pruned, would your position be different, or would your...
Well...
Here's the reason I ask, because if the rule that you would ask, if your plaintiff wins under this set of circumstances, would such a rule not incentivize the state to just stop pruning branches that overhang campsites?
It could, but it calls into question the definition of dangerous condition. And that hinges on the plain language that if it's unreasonable for them to have a facility that's being used, and that's why it's so important that
Ms. Burnett was actually using Campsite 14 as intended, designed, and built. She was using that facility, and what's interesting about the tree overarching is, if you think about the goal line in football, these trees have broken the plank. Okay, they're not really completely segregated from Campsite 14. They're overarching. They've broken that plank hanging over the campsite. So that poses the potential risk, which, based on the record, the state seems to have appreciated because they were pruning in the past. So it doesn't change the analysis really fundamentally from a principal point of law, because the risk is created by the overarching branches. And what's helpful in our case, though, is we have that factual driver to show that there was engagement and modification of those trees to take them out of natural condition, one, and two, that the state appreciated, presumably, the risk associated with the overarching branches.
All of this talk about proximity, increasing risk, how does that tie in to whether this constitutes a public facility in the first place? Help me understand how this is a public facility.
Okay.
The tree.
The tree.
And what does the trilogy to which you've referred tell us about whether the tree can be part of a public facility?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I can have just a moment. The starting point, I believe, Your Honor, would be that it's been admitted and stipulated that the campsite, per se, Campsite 14, is a public facility to start with. Then the question is, I think you're posing, is what's the status of the tree? Does the tree have to be a facility unto itself in order for there to be a waiver of the governmental immunity? I believe the answer, based on the trilogy and otherwise, is no. Even if the tree is not in and of itself a separate facility, it is close enough that it affects the physical condition of Campsite 14, number one, and two, it affects and influences the use of Campsite 14, and therefore, even if the tree is not a separate facility, it so closely is associated in proximity, spatially, one, and two, use and effect of the state of Campsite 14, that indeed the campsite and the tree is still subject to the waiver. In other words, the tree can constitute a dangerous condition even if it's not a separate facility unto itself. And as to the trilogy, I found my notes. In Daniel, at paragraph 21, Daniel indicates that the term physical condition should be broadly construed. So that helps Burnett's position. In Young, not every facility need to have a roof, walls, or other things. Young explains that in note 9 in paragraph 24. In St. Vrain, facilities are defined. You use the definition from Webster's International Dictionary, the one in Burnett's brief. We use the New Collegiate Version. And a facility is something that makes something easier or promotes the intended purpose and goal. The tree, even if you don't per se call it a facility, it still facilitates recreation. It provides shade, shelter, and the ambiance of being in a cozy, sheltered campsite. Anyone who's camped can appreciate the aesthetic value of being in a campsite nestled in the trees. The Native Americans would be appalled that we're separating Mother Earth from, you know, ourselves and all these artificial boundaries.
But the Native Americans didn't write the statute, did they?
I don't believe so.
I think the Native Americans would see a lot differently the idea that we have to maintain the trees in a different shape than they are naturally.
They would, but I'm not sure what the tribe would.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I'm going to accept the fact that we'd love to camp in trees rather than windy places that are full of dust.
Right.
Why doesn't the reference to the word natural and the fact that this improvement was made after the forest already existed and was there, taking advantage of the natural surrounding, why didn't the legislature just intend that the natural surrounding is not the facility, that the facility are the improvements themselves, so there would have to be something in the dangerous condition of a fire pit or a drop-off between the fire pit where you cook your food and where you put your tent that was obvious danger, something like that. Why are we trying to alter nature when the idea is that we want to get out of the city into the parks and enjoy nature?
Well, it's because the state decided to locate the campsite 14 in those trees. The state put it there. And the state decided to maintain and prune those trees. The state's got control of that real property.
Well, where does that stop? Doesn't that encourage just to level out the trees and have campsites that are away from the trees? I mean, do we have to have a patrol every day to check what branch may fall?
No, Your Honor, because the definition of a dangerous condition is based on reasonableness. And that would be a question for the trial court to resolve on liability. It's the tree limbs create a risk of harm to the public and anybody to use that particular site. And
well, aren't there risks that we undertake when we go outside of our houses and we go out in a place where it's forested?
Indeed we do, Your Honor.
Well, the whole Cherry Creek Park is actually preserved in a lot of its natural condition, is it not?
I believe so. I would assume so, Your Honor.
So you're separating out the whole property into little individual pieces where then there have to be, what does the government do now to be sure there's not going to be an accident?
Well, they need to reasonably keep an eye on the trees that overhang the designated campsites where they invite people to come and camp overnight. Their vigilance is relaxed, they're asleep, they're there for extended periods of time, and it's on a highly improved place. It's perfectly reasonable for the state to pay some attention to the nature of the trees that overhang the campsites where they've invited people to stay, Your Honor.
Okay. Excuse me.
There's tons of parts of the park, as I tried to indicate before, about the natural condition of unimproved property. If you're out in a forested area, there would be no waiver of the Government Immunity Act.
Well, as always, when we're dealing with this statute, I hope I'm being heard, it doesn't sound like it. It gets to be a matter of degree. And what you're trying to convince us is that, you know, once you're at a clear facility, once you're at a campsite, if that tree is hanging over it, they've got to keep that safe. But at some point, they don't have to keep trees safe anymore because it's just too far and there's no expectation that you're at a safe campsite, right?
That's correct.
So the problem always for us is this line drawing. And that's what we're trying to kind of press you on. So your position is it's actually hanging over the facility, then it might as well be part of the facility. The facility is not only the land, but the airspace above. Is that kind of what you're
saying? That's correct, Your Honor. There's no magic cylinder that comes down and, you know, pushes out the trees that are overarching because their trunks are immediately adjacent to the physical improvements. They don't even maintain a tree. It's so simple, really, because Ms. Burnett was hit by a tree that was immediately adjacent to the tent pad. And she was occupying the tent pad and the improvements. She wasn't elsewhere. The state would only have to be reasonably maintaining the facilities where there's overarching trees because people are known and invited to use those particular sites.
The trees that don't hang over the campsite, you don't think there's any duty under the statute to maintain those trees?
Generally correct.
So it's just if they're in the airspace, so to speak. That's the extent of your argument?
Well, that's
the cylinder you're saying over the facility, a vertical as opposed to horizontal?
Yes.
Mr. Fowler, can I ask it a different way? What rule would you want us to write then with regard to this? What would the rule be or the holding of this case be?
Thank you, Your Honor. Indeed, that's always the challenge for the court as well as counsel. I believe you look, of course, the plain language of the statute and be guided by that and the structure of the statute. But as a practical matter, here's where Burnett would draw the line. If there's a tree that purports to be in a natural condition, but poses a risk of harm to people using the improved portions of the park. And when I mean improved, the great example is Campsite 14. They're there for a long time. Their vigilance is relaxed. It's nighttime. It's those putative natural conditions, but in this case, they're really not anymore. It's only those trees and those risks that have to be mitigated by the state.
So let me ask it again, though. That's a really long way of saying it. I get what you're saying. But what would the rule be so that we could provide clarity for the state, for future plaintiffs, for the next lawyer who's standing up here? What would the holding be?
That the designated facilities need to be reasonably maintained, to include the campsites, picnic grounds, the designations within the park itself that are high use and where people are invited to use those. Does that help you out? Because those are designated campground, it's a designated campsite.
I don't think it helps enough because it gets us right back into this question of what is it? So the branch hanging over or not, how do we get to that?
Well, it's because the tree, the trunk is close enough to overhang the admitted public facility. If the tree cannot affect the condition of the facility, if the tree cannot affect the use of the condition under the definition of a dangerous condition in the Californian Act, then there's no waiver and no duty.
So your holding would be a public facility is the facility itself and anything that affects it?
Yes.
Okay.
Consistent with the definition of what affects it, and both as far as the physicality of it and the use. The tree affected the use of that campsite because it was close enough that the limb dropped and hit Ms. Burnett.
So how far does that go, though? In this situation, we have branches that directly overhang the site. But if the rule you have is craft is a dangerous condition includes anything that might affect that site, could that also not include, say, a boulder several hundred feet away that rolls down the hill and smashes the tent? That's not something that can directly overhang the site, but it's certainly, under your proposed rule, a dangerous condition that would impact a person's use of that site.
It could be. I mean, the Dia case, Moldovan, and that line of cases that you all have decided over many years have addressed that. The basic intrusion of a foreign object or an object onto a known, clearly man-made public facility, and there is a waiver for that. Under those cases, in most instances, as I read and briefed those cases, Your Honor, so that would be within the holding, within the rule, where I suggest.
Well, isn't the...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
My best on you.
You sure? All right. Well, I'm just wondering whether the Colorado Supreme Court has ever, under 1E, under the recreation waiver, defined public facility to include something that was not a man-made object. So I realize that Rosales and some of the other cases have tried to expand the test using other scenarios that implicate other waivers, but has a natural object like a tree ever been included in the definition of public facility under 1E by this court?
To be honest with you, I can't cite a case to you. I'm not aware of my efforts. But what's...
And the trilogy doesn't do that, right? There's nothing in the trilogy to suggest that it would encompass something other than a man-made object. Am I right?
Not explicitly. That's correct. But nonetheless, the definition of a dangerous condition in Moldovan, Medina, Powell, the Stephan case, all those talk about, you know, there are natural elements. I mean, the water that came out of the sink at campsite 14, that's water. Okay, that's a natural element. What if it was painted and someone drank it and got sick? Would there be no waiver because it's water, a natural element, and therefore separable from the provision through the facility, the man-made facility? I think the answer is clearly no. We will have the Powell case, I believe, addresses something similar, right, with the concrete flow. So that's my answer there, Your Honor.
And just to clarify, I think I understood your position to be, this isn't about the tree itself being a public facility. This is about the tree being a dangerous condition of the improved campsite number 14.
Which is a public facility.
Exactly. Okay, just want to make sure I understood.
Precisely. Thank you. May I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal and or amicus curiae?
Sure.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Spalding?
Thank you, Your Honor. Please support. I echo counsel's comments about it being a pleasure to be here. It certainly was a unique experience. Since there was some discussion about the dangerous condition of, or the waiver exception for a natural condition of unimproved property, I think that might be a place to start here. The CDIA waives immunity for the dangerous condition of a public facility located in a park. When the waivers are written, however, the legislature specifically retained governmental immunity for the natural condition of unimproved property located in the park or recreation area. This provision has been in the Act since the Act was enacted in 1972. This particular exception to the waiver grew out of a report that was issued by a legislative committee before the CGIA was enacted. The committee was charged with the responsibility of studying the problems associated with governmental immunity and coming up with a draft of what later became the CGIA. With respect to the liability of public entities for injuries caused by dangerous conditions in parks, the committee's report discussed the difference between two types of potential liability in parks, one from a man-made dangerous condition, and the other a natural condition. The report explained that with respect to the proposed waiver of immunity for public facilities in the park, the committee intended to draw a distinction between man-made and natural conditions, and that is, and the committee stated, for injuries caused by natural conditions of the park, immunity should be retained. The report concluded that governmental immunity does not apply to man-made objects, but it does apply to natural objects. I've heard some comments from council here indicating that this is not unimproved property, this tree that we're talking about now, because tree's been trimmed before.
Well, does it make sense that we don't want to write a holding or a decision that says, well, if you've ever pruned this tree, the state's liable, but if you haven't ever pruned it, the state is not liable?
I think Justice Wright certainly creates practical problems along this line.
Exactly. Not only that, but a disincentive to ever prune a tree, right? You wouldn't want to go around pruning trees if it might mean that you end up being liable.
Certainly, although I wouldn't want to suggest that threat of loss is the only reason that a governmental entity would do or not do things. That's certainly a cogent reason, but not the only reason.
Point taken. I understand that. So what we have to do is come up with a more principled way of looking at how to draw these kinds of lines so that people who go to parks and camp at an improved camping climate area feel safe, and yet it doesn't bankrupt the state of Colorado pruning every tree in the forest. So how do we do that?
To me, I think some guidance is provided in the legislative committee report, which distinguishes between a constructed facility that the state has to maintain and a property that is not constructed but is natural and unimproved. I believe there has to be some sort of structural change there that is not present here. The Court of McKean case, which is cited by the Court of Appeals, made the same kind of distinction. The King case involved occasions where students had gone into a national forest and, as part of a camping retreat, had placed some rocks in a circle as sort of a crude fire pit, as I understand it. And the argument there was, well, this is now improved property, it's not improved property. The court disagreed and stated that that kind of random placement of rocks is not the kind of construction sufficient to constitute a physical improvement of property. And I think the same analysis applies to these claims here. That is, we have no dispute that, that there were trees adjacent to this campsite, and there were campsites that didn't have trees. These trees had campsites.
Ms. Spalding, can I interrupt for one second? You've relied on the legislative report that predated the CGIA. In the last trilogy that we've talked about, the Young, St. Vrain, and Daniel, did it seem to you that we openly rejected the legislative committee's definition of what a facility was in making the distinction between a man-made object and natural objects? And if that is true, by coming up with the sort of tripartite test that we did for facility, should we give any weight to what the legislative committee report said with regard to natural objects?
I didn't read the three decisions that you were referring to, Justice Coates, as rejecting the legislative committee report. I mean, perhaps a little too narrowly, but the way I read them was the court was making a distinction between the argument made with respect to the kinds of liability that the state might face as opposed to the definition of facility. I don't know if that's necessarily the distinction that I would make as I read the legislative council's report, but I think that's a distinction for me. From a practical standpoint, I don't know if it really makes a lot of difference. That report clearly contemplates one way or another whether they're referring to public facilities or they're referring to the natural condition of unimproved property that they intended. In fact, before the CGIA was enacted to place liability on the state squarely with respect to things that were constructed versus things that weren't. That comes in loud and clear. So I understand the distinction that in cases, I guess the result rather than exactly how the court placed those particular distinctions.
Okay, thank you. Let me follow up with one question about that, though. And I'm not sure about your opposing counsel's position on this, the way we're using the wordings, but what are you indicating that to be a dangerous condition of a public facility, the dangerous condition must be the public facility, or could something that's not the public facility nevertheless be a dangerous condition of a public facility? As a boulder rolling down the hill, or a limb falling, or maybe wild animals, whatever. But could something be a dangerous condition of a public facility without actually qualifying as the facility?
I don't think so. Because that's where I personally draw the line. So I'm looking at this from the state's point of view, and the state needs to know what they're responsible for and what they're not.
Why do you think then that they have both those words? Why is there even such a thing as a dangerous condition on a public facility if they're exactly the same?
Well, I think the state is liable for dangerous conditions. I guess I'm not.
Is every dangerous condition, let me come at it this way, so something has to be on a public facility, is that correct, in order to qualify just at the very beginning? If it's not a public facility, we're not even talking about it.
I think the state has a duty to maintain a public facility.
Right.
And those things are determined to be components of the public facility or the public facility the state has a duty to maintain. That to me is the line, yes.
So that's where we start our conversation. And so we have to decide whether something's a public facility, and then we have to decide whether something's a dangerous condition on that public facility. But they're two different kinds of questions, aren't they?
Yes, although I think, as I understand the Young and St. Vrain cases in particular, there are things that can be components of public facilities that aren't necessarily smack dab on the facility itself. I understand that there has to be some rather substantial connection between a component of a facility that isn't on the facility itself, and the facility or the items that make up the facility. Frankly, I don't know the natural condition to ever do that, ever. I consider possibilities, for instance, that are perhaps a little extreme, but makes sense to me. I think a natural condition is essentially wasn't one anymore. A tree turned into a restaurant tree house, a tree with the trunk collapsed so the car could drive through. I think those are arguably no longer natural conditions, but a tree is a tree, and a tree is a tree, whether you turn it or you don't, and a tree isn't part of recreation. A tree is there, as we have stipulated in this case, to provide habitat for birds and animals. There are thousands of them in Cherry Creek State Park that can get that.
But they're not thousands of them that hang over campgrounds.
That is.
So let's talk about the tree that hangs over a campground, because it had to be hanging right over the branch would have fallen on the tent, which was, without question, in a safe spot, a tent pad or whatever on this campground, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Okay. My problem with expanding my worldview of what a state has a duty to maintain is that it gets into areas where the state would have no idea exactly what their maintenance duty was. Just as Martha said, and mentioned the Boulder example, which is actually something that I was considering earlier as well. I would hope the state isn't in the position of often placing campsites at the base of Boulder fields, but if in fact that would create the kind of problem I think has been presented here, that is, where does it stop if someone's camping in a big time canyon? Is there a duty to, if in fact that was a state campground?
Sure. I just want to narrow your focus, because would it be so hard for the state to go out and say, oh look, this tree is hanging over this campground, and I think maybe this branch needs to be cut, because the big wind comes and could fall.
No, I don't think it would be hard to do that. My problem is what that does beyond that one tree. That is, if the state's duty extends beyond the actual facility itself, and I think under the Young and St. Rain case, it's pretty clear that it would, then where does the state's duty stop? It's an easier example with a campground, perhaps. It gets a little harder with other examples that haven't come before this court. Yeah.
Well, tell us what you're thinking. Where does it get harder?
Let's see. I like to take it out of the campground, but I'm sure the campground mode right now. If the campsite is next to the Big Thompson River, is there some duty on the part of the state to make sure that flash flooding doesn't occur, or if there's going to be rain, that they stick up some kind of protection against raging water? We have certainly lost one on highways all the time. I hate to think of that having a campground, but we are not in the state, and that can occur. I was in Prospero State Park a few weeks ago, and I know that there are food trails, that is, paved trails there, which I understand, perhaps anyway, would come within the court's definition of the public facility. Those trails are right next to canyons. I'm assuming there's falling rocks there. Those are the sorts of things I can think of. I don't know that it happens all the time. On the other hand, I don't think this happens much either. But I think that the state's responsibility has to be clear. What I don't want to have is state employees trying to figure out what it is might possibly affect a public facility. That net is too broad.
Could I ask one? It seems natural whenever we have these discussions, and you seem to be doing it here, sort of merging from the question, what did the legislature intend to waive in terms of an immunity, with when would the state be liable for negligence? The question, you said duty a few times. When would the state have a duty? But that's not what we're talking about here, right? That is, the legislature clearly did not waive immunity with regard to every tort they commit. So whether they would be negligent in some way and be liable in tort but for an immunity, that doesn't affect whether they waive the immunity. So we're concerned primarily with what did the, how much did the legislature intend to waive? Is that not right?
Yes, I think it's entirely.
And so what is there about this discussion about the limb and about the dangerous condition, given the language that the legislature used, that indicates how far they intended to waive? Not whether they would be liable, not whether they would be committing a tort, but rather, what did they intend to waive?
And I'm sorry, I'm not clear on the question.
Okay, well, I felt in your response to Justice Rice, you were getting off into questions about when the state would be liable or not. When, in the sense that when would the state have committed a tort? When would it have a duty to not be a tortfeasor? But that's not really the question, isn't it? Isn't it a more narrow question? Is when did they intend to waive their immunity from being a tortfeasor?
I don't understand. Yes, no, I absolutely agree. I think we got into a discussion about the practical effects. I understand it's, of course, duty to consider those factors. But I don't mind what I think anyway is when you're in the statute, which is that there's a waiver exception for the natural condition of unimproved property.
And can I just follow up right there? I'm taking up a lot of your time. But so do you think that by putting in this specific provision about the state retains immunity with regard to natural conditions of unimproved property, that that would be the only way in which the state would have retained its immunity, would not have waived its immunity with regard to a dangerous condition of a public facility? I guess the way I'm asking that is there something in between? Could it not be a dangerous condition of a public facility, even though it doesn't fit within a natural condition of unimproved property?
Yes, I believe the answer is yes, absolutely. As you indicated, Justice Coates, CGIA waives immunity for the dangerous condition of a public facility in the park. A dangerous condition is either the physical condition itself of the facility, which is pretty much what we've been talking about so far, or the use thereof. And the court has clarified the term the use thereof to indicate that it modifies the term physical condition and then expanded or broadened the interpretation of physical condition. As we've already discussed, and I think as given the St. Brain case and the Young case, this court established a tree, which is adjacent to this campsite, is not part of the physical condition of a public facility. Because it's a natural condition, and also the language of remote camping. The injuries also don't arise from Ms. Burnett's use of the physical condition of the campsite because the dangerous condition of the tree, assuming, has no connection with the actual physical condition of the campsite, which is here in the public facility. Even though the court has given an expansive interpretation of the term physical condition, the court has never said, at least not in any case I've been able to find, that the dangerous condition referred to in the statute, that's 2410.161e, can be disconnected to the actual physical condition of the facility in question. And I'm referring specifically to the Jenks case. I can follow these cases and read the Jenks case along with the case and the UA case, in which this court specifically looked at that provision we had. And none of those cases indicated that a dangerous condition that is not somehow part of the physical condition of a public facility can come within the waiver.
We've got to apply the words of the statute, however, and I am concerned that when they zero in on reimposing the immunity for natural condition of any unimproved property, they did draw a line between the natural areas of something like Cherry Creek Park and the improved property? I mean, so that's my problem. What is unimproved property? And it certainly seems if you put a campsite underneath a grove of cottonwood, cottonwood are notoriously soft, liable to split, age, and fall. It seems that families, when they go out there and they expect to have a safe place for families to recreate in an improved area, that you either wouldn't locate it in such a grove of trees or you would have to maintain it. I actually think that the girl that got hurt here has a point here. When you read the reimposition of the sovereign immunity, it plainly differentiates unimproved from improved. So how do you get away from the logical concept that this is improved property and that the forest effect in the campsite is part of the improvement?
I think, Your Honor, again, I would return to the legislative council. I think that makes that
pretty. Well, the problem is that we have to actually construe the words and within the context of the phrase. That's the canon of statutory construction, right? And the report is not the legislation. I don't know what happened to this legislation as it went through. But certainly the legislators had to look at the language and decide how they wanted to frame this. If they wanted to say any natural condition, they would have not put in the unimproved property. I think you're just arguing for nature is nature and wherever it appears, but that's not what they did. By the natural condition, and then they add some words of any unimproved property, and the property is not the whole of the Cherry Creek State Park, obviously. It's the improved portions of the property. Would you agree at least to that? So you want to take words out of this phrase. You want to subtract words, something we're not supposed to do. Right? I mean, your argument is natural conditions, that's the immunity.
Yes, my argument is natural conditions, that's immunity. And I think going into beyond what the legislative council has suggested and also the Kincaid suggested, what constitutes an improvement or what doesn't perhaps constitute an improvement.
Well, a campsite that draws families should be a safe place for them to camp, should it not?
I have to go by the wording of the statute, and what I see in the statute is that there's an exception to the waiver. I don't think the waiver applies either, but there's an exception to the waiver, and I believe the exception to the waiver applies to this case. I think the court is going to, I think personally, it would be very difficult were I to write some kind of rule on what constitutes improved or unimproved property to talk about whether someone mowed the grass or how much the property had been disturbed. Maybe it had been disturbed a little bit and then it went back to its natural condition. There's all kinds of scenarios that I can imagine here where somebody might think that's improved or someone doesn't. What I know is that these trees were not part of a public facility, and that's been established by the court in the Young and St. Grain cases. And this tree wasn't made into something else other than a tree, or these trees, whichever tree we're talking about here. They were trees and not developed into something that was, you could consider some kind of structure. That's the only distinction that I can make in my head that has some kind of, that gives direction to any part of here. I think to a certain extent it is true that if you go camping, you take certain risks, and maybe that shouldn't be so. But if you go and camp without any trees, maybe you get sunburn.
Well, no, I would say if you go into a wilderness area, you expect whatever happens, happens. You go into an improved state park located like this is in a huge urban area, and you bring your family in for the weekend, you expect that natural hazards are going to be ameliorated so that somebody doesn't get killed in the middle of the night or seriously hurt, right? And isn't there a cap anyway on the amount of damages under the statute? There's a limitation on how much taxpayer funds have to be paid out, right?
Yes, sir.
And what is that limitation?
Well, that's $350,000.
So this idea of a multi-million dollar verdict does not even exist. Even if there's a waiver of sovereign immunity, there's a cap on what this victim can be awarded in terms of damages if, in fact, negligence is proven, correct?
Correct. All I'm saying, I think there has to be some guidance, and I appreciate that that campgrounds should be safe and hopefully they are. And as I've mentioned before, I think there are a number of reasons that a safe entity would improve public property that has nothing to do with their fear of liability, just because they do it. But there has to be a limit. There has to be a place where everybody understands that this is where the line is drawn. My perspective is, of course, state employees.
And you're, so the holding that you want us to write in is, if it's man-made and it causes harm, the state did not waive. If it's not man-made and it causes harm, the state did not waive liability. Period.
I'd be a little cautious on that just because I can foresee extraordinary circumstances where an active condition possibly could
what,
be
what one?
Part of the public facility. The ones I mentioned,
just
I think...
driving through the big red wood.
Yeah, and
okay, but other than that?
Other than those, I think the state has a duty to maintain public facilities. And public facilities are something, well, are what the courts already define them to be.
And that would be your position as well. If the trees were inside, you had a sidewalk going around the public camping facility, you had trees in the middle of that, still the state would not waive immunity if those trees fell over and hurt people.
If somebody could make an argument that as in the Young and St. Brand cases, if the tree was, if some natural condition, if it's a tree or if it's a bunch of moss or whatever it is, if somebody came to the court and was able to convince you all that this natural condition was a component of the public facility, then I think there is a duty to maintain there.
So, in other words, if the trunk of the tree is located smack in the middle of the approved site and shades the picnic table and the tent pad, and those branches fall, immunity has not or has been waived because it's incorporated into the site, but if the tree trunk is off to the side and those same branches overhang the site, it hasn't been waived. I'm just trying to understand the distinction that you're drawing.
I don't think the location really makes a difference here.
A tree is a tree.
Unless under the court's analysis in the cases that have just been decided or were decided a few months ago, a tree is a component of the public facility, and it could be, not in this case, I think, but it theoretically could be, then I think the entity, the city, whoever it is, has an obligation there.
Well, how does it become a component if not based on its location? I mean, I suppose...
Well, I think in the Young, I think it's the Young case, talking about a walkway, is a good example. The walkway, as I understand it, was between the school and what the court determined to be a recreation area. The question is, this child, I understand, was on the walkway, slipped and fell. Is this walkway part of the recreation facility? And the court determined that it was not. Because in part it didn't promote the broader common purpose of children's playing, instead it has multiple purposes, some of which have nothing to do with recreation. And if you, as I understand, of course, you don't need to do that kind of analysis with any structure or natural object if in the unlikely circumstance that might actually be a component of the
Well, if you were to follow that logic, then people who decided to place this campground in an area that was surrounded by trees were probably doing that because the trees made this campsite nicer. It was a component of their design of this particular campsite.
I can't make that far, but that's possible. That's certainly possible. I don't know, and it's for the court's determination as whether just having a tree around or having a shade of a few vines is a sufficient nexus to the purpose of having a campsite that that tree becomes a component, that natural condition becomes a component of a public facility.
Can I ask, you had indicated in your brief that you didn't want to set up a situation where the state would stop trimming dangerous overhead branches, I think was the phrase. And I guess I'm wondering, why would you bother to do that at all unless it posed, in fact, a risk to persons occupying that improved portion of the site? I mean, by having done so, this ties back to the natural condition of unimproved property. If by trimming those branches, isn't that an improvement because you're eliminating what would otherwise be a risk to persons in that site? I'm sorry, I used up your time.
You can go ahead and answer that question, please.
Yes, you are eliminating risk, but is an improvement a structural type of improvement, such as was cited in the King case where the legislative council before that one lost, and I think you have to draw that line somewhere. As I said, there could be all kinds of minor improvements in that sense, and discouraging the state from making the device into the same such a body of this is the wrong way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, okay, whoever? Mr. Fowler, not Mr. Poole?
Jack, I've got 4 minutes, Your Honor. I'd like to just make three very short comments and then give 3 minutes to amicus if that is acceptable to the court.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And if you'd like to hear more from the amicus about Rosales, you know, if you'd like to extend the argument a few minutes, we'll certainly welcome argument.
No, I don't think so.
Motion denied. Thank you, Your Honor. First, Justice Boatwright, your question about has there been a case that incorporated anything about a natural feature into a waiver? The answer to that is the 2002 amendment created a backcountry landing exception to the immunity waiver, where a pertinent land is included in the exception to the waiver. That's the section 2410.106.1.5c. The legislature carved out the exception and specifically included a permanent land. That would be a natural feature. So there's a statutory discussion that's briefed for you as well. And I think that might go to your question. Then finally, on the holding can be fairly clear. When the state designs in a quasi-natural feature into the government, the facility, which they did here, the state admitted they designed in the trees and the risk was designed in, they should be responsible. Thank you. I'll see you the rest of my time.
All right, thanks. Mr. Fallon?
May I please report? John Hoare on behalf of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association. And briefly, I think Mayor's counsel covered a lot of the ground that I would have covered, so I don't want to belabor much, but I was asked to come speak today specifically about how the Rosales opinion factors into this and what this court ought to do regarding that opinion. So a couple of comments regarding that. First of all, the Rosales opinion sets up this test where a pre-existing natural feature such as a tree can become or be considered a part of a public facility if it's an integral part of the facility and essential for the intended use of the facility. Several problems with that, and the CTLA on this basis encourages this court to reject it and adopt a more functional test. The first is that it's not grounded in any way in the language of the immunity waiver at issue. The Court of Appeals test is simply not grounded in the statutory language in any respect. Secondarily, the Court of Appeals opinion on Rosales provides essentially no guidance concerning how to apply, how to determine when a particular feature is an integral part of a facility or essential for its intended use. So it's essentially an open invitation for trial courts to utilize essentially uncabined and unguided discretion in deciding on a case-by-case basis whether a particular feature fits within the immunity waiver. Thirdly, the Rosales opinion doesn't deal with any of the framework analysis concerning how to cabin what is a public facility, what is the relevant park or recreation area that this court defined in the trilogy. So CTLA encourages this court, if it finds it necessary to address Rosales, to reject that framework. In terms of
You're on roll, excuse me.
trying to get through a lot.
What will we say about Gonzales? How do we deal with it in our opinion?
Well, CTLA encourages this court to disapprove the analysis in Rosales to the extent that it's necessary to address it, and secondarily replace it with more of a functional test that gives harmony to all the provisions of the statute. And I think that Justice Hobbs articulated this better than I could, so I'm not really going to attempt to replicate it, but the General Assembly carving out an exception for natural conditions included both the phrase natural condition and of unimproved property. And so in order for that, in order for the exception to the immunity waiver to apply, the condition has to both be natural and has to be of unimproved property. The problem here is that this tree, as Mr. Fowler detailed and has explained in brief, was not of unimproved property. It's situated either immediately adjacent to the campsite. You've got branches that are directly overhanging the campsite. It poses a risk to people lawfully using the campsite to recreate for the campsite's intended purpose. And so to draw an arbitrary distinction and say, well, just because it's a tree that may have at one time been a natural feature, that doesn't make it of unimproved property when there is an admitted public facility constructed in immediately adjacent to and around it. And I see that I've used the remainder of the time, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ms. Fowler. Thank you very much. I hope you will answer some of the students' questions. I really would appreciate that. The court will be in recess.